Nice to see everybody, as usual. Nice to have such a renovated hall. I'm happy, but probably not half as happy as you guys are, because you're here all the time. I happened to be out in California last week myself and flew over those fires. They're north of all of the populous area of the Southern California Basin. They're in three or four different places. And the wind's shifting, blowing it toward the north, so that's been a huge help. But a few days ago, it was only 5% contained. So they are calling that the worst fire crisis that they've ever had. And if the wind were to have shifted in a different direction, it would have threatened a great deal of the populace out there. So it's very, very dangerous. American railroad tracks are exactly 56 and a half inches wide. Do you know why? What a strange measurement. They're 56.5 inches wide because the first rail lines were built by the English in this country, and that's the gauge they used in the old country. Now, the reason that they used that to build their railroad tracks, I know there were a few exceptions, but primarily they came up with that measurement is because that's the way the tramways were built, with the same exact spacing. And that was predicated on older wagon ruts that ran throughout England that used the same spacing. And if they did change the width of those ruts in the roads, that would break the wheels and the wagons that were being used to navigate. But why in the world were those different ruts also 56.5 inches wide? Well, that's because the roads were built by the Romans, who arrived in England in 54 BC, leaving it about 400 years later. The width of a Roman chariot track was 56.5 inches, because the track equaled about the size of two horses pulling a chariot. Such curious dimensions continue today. As an example, the space shuttle that sits on the launching pad with two large booster rockets is carried there from Utah, where it's constructed by Morton Thiokol. The engineers would have loved to have built those booster rockets in a larger dimension, but they had to transport them by rail, and that rail to carry them through the Rocky Mountain tunnels that could only accommodate the width of a train that was 56.5 inches tracks wide. The bottom line is this major design of arguably the world's most advanced transportation system was determined by the width of two horses' rear ends. Now you think about that for a minute, and you realize, well, that's weird. To be held hostage, modern technology held hostage by some outmoded way of doing things. You and I can't change that in this life, but have we ever wrestled with outmoded thinking at work or at school where maybe better ideas were turned down? Maybe you had an idea for something only to be said, addressed in the following way. This is the way we do it around here. This is the way we always have done it around here. This is the way it's always going to be. That could be rather frustrating if you thought there was a better way. Now, I want to ask this question. Are you victimizing yourself by outmoded thinking? Outmoded thinking, for example, your strategy for getting results with God. Do you ever want results? Do you never need answers to prayer? Do you ever want a response? And you need it, and maybe you need it now, or you need it in the future. Do you have an outmoded strategy that you're working with, where maybe you're not sure that that answer will come? You might doubt. It's all dependent on how much faith we have, how much confidence we have in God to respond to what we need, to our prayer, and to the way we live. Now, we need faith for the future. If you know anything about prophetic future events, you know we're poised to live through some tumultuous times, facing enormous challenges. Wouldn't we want to have up-to-date thinking, not outmoded thinking, outmoded strategy for facing those dangerous future times? The paradox in Bible prophecy to me is that even though all of us understand what's at stake, what the future is going to bring, that many people have outmoded strategy, that become very complacent with it and lack the active faith to get results from God, the faith to know that God will be there for them in the future, and will slack off when they know better and understand. And yet, of course, among the same group of believers, there are others that apparently do understand, that do want to have an active relationship with God, that can expect results from their prayer and expect results of good, obedient living, and an obedient living that keeps them focused on the kingdom of God and determined to be able to endure it through the end, to live on through eternity. So it is a paradox that to be so close to the major events that are going to unfold very much soon before our eyes, a paradox that some would be ready and others not. And I think the difference revolves around outmoded spiritual thinking or the lack of a good spiritual strategy. I'd like to analyze this strange paradox and then outline five major strategies to develop sufficient faith for the future. Faith so that we know that God can answer our prayers. Faith so that we know that God is for us, that He does bless those that live according to His way of life. This is not some blind exercise, but it is a real experience that we have. Let's take a look at the paradox first as it's identified in Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3. We'll look at two mindsets very quickly here. One's the Philadelphian mindset, the other Laodicean, and I know that you all understand the basic principles that are involved here. But to review, let's look at Revelation 3 and verse 8. Here Christ speaking says to people that could include us, hopefully would, I know your works. I've set before you an open door, no man can shut it. For you have a little strength and have kept my word. Notice that, kept my word. Now that's not an outmoded strategy. And it has not denied my name. People that would include us at the end time, that would be spiritually focused. And at the end of verse 9, God reiterates how He has loved this particular group of people. He goes on to say, verse 10, because you have kept the word of my patience, takes vision to do that, and belief that this way is the right way and that God's way works. Because you have kept the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation or tribulation, which will come upon the entire world to try them that dwell on the earth. I can read that, I can tell you that that's true, but I don't really know what that's like. Having think back to the time I gave the sermon on the Day of Trumpets, I can tell you what it's like in one sense academically to have a baby, but I don't really know. Behold, I come quickly. Verse 11, hold fast to that which you have, that no man shall take your crown. We've seen so many examples of people taking other people's crowns, within and without. And the blessings are there. He that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. And I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which comes out from heaven, from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. And that, I hope, will be applicable and said of all of us. And there's no need to worry about that because the outcome is in our hands. We can determine our own future if we exercise the right choices. So that comes if we desire to have a relationship with God and have the faithful relationship at that. If we just keep a place here in Revelation 3 and turn now over to Hebrews 11, which is called the faith chapter by many. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6. Fundamental here, it says, Hebrews 11 verse 6, but without faith, it is impossible to please Him. You talk about an outmoded strategy for the future. There's nothing worse, nothing more scary in my mind to conjure than for to consider the fact that people that would know the Bible would want and be willing to blindly travel through the future with no strategy with the relationship with God. to me, that would be incongruous with why we are here. So verse 6, without faith it is impossible to please God. We don't have a relationship with God without faith. For he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. An up-to-date strategy earns those, or garners those particular benefits, the rewards and the blessings of God. Not that we can earn them, but that they are given to us in exchange for an effort to try to have a relationship and develop faith in God and his way of life. Now back to Revelation 3, we see in contrast to what we saw for the Philadelphians. And this makes it such a strange paradox. In Revelation 3 and verse 14, this is what could inadvertently happen if we have an outmoded strategy. If we just do things the way everybody's always done them and not invest in the future with God and just kind of go with the flow, here's what could happen to any of us. Verse 14, and to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, these things says the Amen, that's Christ, the faithful and the true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, and you're neither hot nor cold. And I wish that you were hot nor cold, but more importantly, hot. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, God speaking says he will spew such people out of his mouth. And he says in verse 17, because you say, this is not because God assesses it, but because according to their own assessment, they're self-sufficient, they think. They're complacent. Because you're the ones that say, I am rich and increase with goods and have need of nothing, which is not true. They think that spiritually they're okay, just the way they are. And they don't know that they are blind and wretched and miserable, spiritually speaking, poor, and so forth. I counsel you to buy of me gold tried in the fire that you might be rich. And this is kind of a last-ditch plea to this particular group. But why live a roller coaster life of fear, anxiety, and heartburn by waiting till the very end to try to get something going with God? And this is the problem you see in Matthew 25 with the five foolish virgins. Oh, things are going in the wrong direction. Oh, I guess I better get a relationship going with God. I guess I need more faith. At that point, it was too late because the wise told the foolish, go out and buy for yourselves, you know, the necessary oil, and the bridegroom came before they were ready and got back. Why would we want to ever get to the edge like that? Well, I don't think that's what we want to do. But if we get very, very busy, we may forget what is at stake. And to the Laodiceans, God says, I counsel to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that you might be spiritually rich, and white raiment, that you might be clothed, and that the shame of such nakedness not appear. And he pleads with them to anoint their eyes with eye salve, that they might see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent. Well, to obviate the need to be chastened, why not just choose to develop a relationship with God? And I'd like to examine, as I mentioned, several reasons. We have time for about five major strategies for developing sufficient faith for the future. Why would we want to end up with a Laodicean mindset when we could reap the rewards of the Philadelphian mindset by striving to have the kind of relationship that Christ would outline for those people? And to be loyal. Christ raised the rhetorical question. I won't turn there, but over in, I think I will. You may. Luke 17, verse 26. Luke 17, verse 26, first of all, leading up to his question. His question being, you know, when Christ returns to the earth, will he find faith on the earth? I think the answer to that is an emphatic yes. But in Luke 17, verse 26, it says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man, that they did eat, and they drank, they married wives, and they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered to the ark and the flood came and took them all away. Likewise also, as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, drank, bought, sold, planted, built. But in the same day Lot went out of Sodom, it rained, and fire and brimstone from heaven came and destroyed them all. Even thus it shall be in that day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day he which shall be upon the housetop, and so forth, not come down. There's a sense of urgency. Remember Lot's wife. Well, if we remember Lot's wife, we realize she had no strategy at all. She saw no value in having a relationship with God. And if she knew that God existed, she saw no reason to invest any time in it. Outmoded strategy. She was complacent. I don't think she knew as much as the Laodiceans, but it didn't really matter because the end result was about the same. So what would the wise do? What could we do for the time that we have? I want to outline several important strategies. The first being having vision for the future. Nothing new, but do you see yourself in the millennium? Do you see yourself in God's kingdom? Do you have positive expectations about your future? Are you sure that you can cross the finish line and then share the eternity with Christ and with God the Father and with other brethren and the saints of God? Do we think about that very often? Or are we maybe possibly so busy with so many other very important but time-demanding activities and menial activities and house responsibilities and extended family responsibilities and work responsibilities and overtime perhaps and maintenance of vehicles and other property that we might have and things that we can't live without, plus other future planning and church activities and then being here and then having enough time to pray and study and maintain a relationship? And, well, have I forgotten anything? We can get so busy in the here and the now and going here and going everywhere and be maybe so, what should I say, stinking busy, that we might lose focus of knowing where we're always going to end up. And so it is that we have to have that vision. It takes time to cultivate it. It takes time to review it, maybe in prayer as well as occasional Bible study and maybe various word or note reminders around the house, whatever it takes. Do you see yourself in the future? Do you see yourself living in Jerusalem, for example, working with Christ, helping to bring a surviving humanity out of the great tribulation into God's burgeoning kingdom? You know, vision is what carried the saints of God in the past. Sometimes it was very difficult to endure certain trials. What if you were the Apostle Paul, for example? Stoned, left for dead 3 or 4 times, been in shipwreck, bobbing and up and down and shivering in the cold water, hanging on to a log or a timber, something that, you know, something snapped off of a ship. Doesn't sound like much fun to be thrown into prison and be hated by people. So there was a point in time where Christ appeared to Paul and said, "Be of good cheer. You know, you've witnessed to me here in Jerusalem. I want you in Rome." You know, there are times when he had God reveal himself. There was a time when he was caught up into the third heaven. He said it was marvelous. This is over in Corinthians. He says, "You know, I can't tell you everything that about it, but I heard voices. I heard, I don't know, angelic singing in perfect key, and splendid harmony. I don't know what he heard exactly, but he was moved, and he was astounded. And even Habakkuk and some of the other writers, Isaiah, when they were able to have a glimpse of God's activity at God's throne, they were just totally dumbfounded, stunned, in a daze for extended time, made a profound impression on them. But one of the things that a profound impression can do that is a real asset is that you can think, well, yeah, I remember what that was like, at least to some extent, and I know that when I'm there again, it's going to be even more real, and I won't miss the detail. I won't be as overwhelmed, but it's exciting. It's worth living for. That's where my future is going to be." That vision helped him to endure the current trials that he faced. It helped Stephen to endure his martyrdom. There have been people that were tremendously helped by vision. Christ had the vision. He didn't want to die prior, you know, humanly speaking, just on the eve of his crucifixion. He prayed all night. But he had vision and he had memory of what it was like to be with God. And he said in John 17 and verse 5, we cover this as part of the Passover ceremony. He prayed to God the Father, and he said, you know, give me the glory that I had before the world was. At that point, he was getting more detailed awareness of his prior life when he was the Logos, before he was a human being born on this earth. And he remembered that, and it was encouraging. And if we remember where we are going and why we were born, and we have that vision, then we have all the more reason to make the right choices, to do the right thing, even if there's temptation around us or other distractions. I marvel about others that have lived before us. For example, the prophet Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had vision of God's way. They knew that God's way worked. And here they were growing up in a degenerate country that was declining. Their currency was declining. Their morality was falling apart in the nation of Judah. And it got to be so bad that God determined that they were going to go a national punishment for their sins. And so he allowed Nebuchadnezzar to capture the nation. Now, a lot of people, especially the youth back then, might think, well, what's there to live for? We're going into captivity. Or we will soon. Nebuchadnezzar and his army will get here. And the country's going down. We might as well live for the moment. There's no logic to sticking it out or trying to stand up for a better future or a morality or better standard of living. God's way always works. It always pays to obey God in any circumstance at all. You could ask Joseph that back when he was a prisoner and then sold to other people in Egypt. Or you could ask Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel, and then people, our peers today. God's way works. It's important to have vision in that, to know that it not only works now, but it will always work. I think that sometimes our youth, and I've mentioned this before, will get discouraged. Think, well, here we are in the United States, and things are maybe going downhill. Will I be able to have a job? Can I get married this side of the return of Christ? And I think that the opportunity for all that is still excellent. I want our people, I think we all do, want our youth as well as everybody else to know there is a future. The God's way works at this time. And that if we develop faith and have the right spiritual strategies, that we can reap blessings in this life as well as the life to come. Life is worth living. It is not the pits. It should be an exciting time and time of opportunity. And if there is, in fact, even increasing, declining employment, we have always encouraged our people to get their education, become highly skilled in areas that the world cannot live without. This is valuable time to be able to do that, to always be in demand, and to be able to have the blessing of working and earning a living, a good living. These are things that God wants, but we have to put all the strategies together. And I don't think this is of a surprise to anybody, but I think we need to reassure each other that God's way works. You can't expect those blessings, though, with an outmoded strategy. You have to invest in order to receive. So having vision is important because it encourages us to keep with it, make right decisions day after day. It's what we do day after day, not wait till the very end like the Laodiceans and say, oh my, it's late in the game, I better hustle, I better get it together. Silly, isn't it? Why live in that kind of excitement? It's not necessary. Moving on, praying for spiritual discernment. That is important. When we want to have enough sufficient faith for the future, we need to have spiritual discernment. That discernment comes with God's Holy Spirit. A classic case to me that I've used over in Tampa, and I just marvel at this. I had the opportunity to talk to a custodial worker, worked on custodial in Pasadena at Ambassador College for about 30 years. Been in the church a lot longer. In that 30 years, she saw a lot of things, a lot of good times, the construction of some key buildings, the auditorium, some of the concert series, some of the crowning achievements of Mr. Armstrong with God's help on the campus. Also saw some of the other things that went on, different prominent personalities coming and going that seem so important, maybe lifted up with pride or whatever, gone. Saw people that once in a while were hypocritical, while there were many others that were that don't get any fanfare or notation in any honorable sense, that were very loyal. But still, over that period of time, there at the epicenter of God's work, it would be easy, as it was for some others, to maybe be overwhelmed with the hypocritical example of a few and allow that to take one's crown. And I asked her just a general question. I said, what was it like working here at the college? And she said, without hesitation, she said, I considered it an honor to work at, she said, God's headquarters on this earth. That's the way she viewed her job. She was helping to enhance the Garden of Eden, in a sense. And she didn't have any jaded or negative things to say. It was all positive. Now, everything in this world is not always positive. I think of the example of King David, or before he was king, he was able to look at wicked King Saul and still see God's hand in the picture. That's spiritual discernment. That's God's spirit at work, to be able to see that. And I so wish that many people over time could have had that same approach. I remember being in the northeastern part of the U.S. in 1974, and that was the first example of adversity that I ever saw in God's church. And it was predicated on certain gripes, and some of them were true, and some were not. But attitude was everything. Faith and discernment was everything. A proper strategy to ask for God's help, to be able to see things the way God saw them, to be able to have vision for the future, and to employ the other strategies that I'll talk about in a few minutes, really made a difference. Spiritual discernment. Thinking back to the example we had, the church member over in Baltimore, his last name was Unger. And he said, I have a brother who wrote Unger's Bible Dictionary. That man is so brilliant. He knows so much more about the Bible than I'll ever know. He's a walking encyclopedia of information. He knows even parts of Greek and Hebrew. He says, but he just doesn't get it when it comes to the holy days. He doesn't understand the whole purpose behind the Sabbath. He just doesn't, is not able to connect the dots in some very fundamental things, such as why were you born? He doesn't know that, but he sure knows the Bible in a sense. But he lacks the spiritual discernment. You never know when you'll need it. Mr. Pinelli mentioned one time about a widow who was approached by somebody that was trying, a scam artist, and said, I tell you what, you seem to be a nice person. I'm connected with law enforcement, FBI. We're trying to apprehend some wicked people, and they're swindling people out of their money. And we need a couple individuals such as yourself, if you're willing, to help us, to help your government, to be able to nab these people and to pose as willing investors, where you sign over a certain amount of your money and we monitor it, and then when they're ready to transact it in some other way, then we'll move in and arrest them, and we'll return your money with interest, and we'll give you a bonus, and you're helping us to be able to help the bad people or capture the wicked people. In simplistic terms, they were explaining that, and she was somewhat naive. And she thought that they were friendly, they were nice people, that they really were honest, that they were part of the law enforcement. She looked at their fake ideas, and she said, well, this sounds good. And she was not very discerning on her own. She had no street savvy smarts at all. But she said, that doesn't sound right. She said, I'll just run it by my close relative and friend. She said, that doesn't sound right. She really didn't know what they were talking about. But somebody was looking out for her, because she had enough spiritual sense to have an impression. She just wasn't sure. There was a man once, he pastored a church far away from here, and a long time ago, he made mention in one of the recent sessions we had at a conference, that when he arrived at this one particular congregation, his very first Sabbath, he got up to speak. He was doing the announcements, and just something didn't settle right with him. And when he got down, he sat next to his wife. He says, "There's something wrong here. I don't know what it is. There's something wrong." And it really ate at him. And so he decided to fast that week about it. And soon thereafter, he got a phone call from somebody. "Oh, you need to know about this particular flare-up, this problem that these people are having." And anyway, to make a long story short, it kind of was a thread that he followed. And in a couple of weeks, he found that there were seven couples committing adultery in the congregation, separate couples. And so he realized he had to deal with that, and he did. And I think most people were salvaged, and it all worked out in the end. But something didn't seem right. Didn't know what it was. But there are times when you and I need to have discernment. We need to have it, and we need to trust God for it. And God is willing to help us. Because the decisions that we may be called upon to make in the future may be overwhelming, may be difficult, may require special discernment. And you can't have enough of it. I don't know of any minister ever that would say that he has enough. And it's so important to have God's Spirit at work. God's Spirit comes to those that obey Him. Acts 5, verse 32. And God gives His Holy Spirit to those that have faith. I assume that the Philadelphians have great faith, even though it's not specifically stated in the Scripture, because they are highly praised by God as being loyal, faithful, obedient, faithful indeed. And that comes from increased obedience to God. Let's move on now. We've looked at the need to pray for spiritual discernment. We need to have vision for the future. A third area, and I mention this especially because life is so busy. And I marvel at some of the people that what they go through. Talked to a number of people recently that do very well financially, but their morale is not very high. They never know when they're going to be downsized. They never know when they're going to be taken over by another company. And it seems like they're asked to make bricks without straw. So, yeah, the money might be good for some, but they have to work hard, longer hours and even longer hours. And as one person said, "I have a supervisor that's always after me. You know, hey, you were 25 seconds longer on that phone call with that request made by the public, somebody complaining about a product." And the middle management stressed out because, they got to justify why they're being paid what they're being paid. So then they want to find, they're riding hard on their employees. Well, if you don't do a good job, we're going to outsource it. There's somebody in India that would be happy to work, or somebody elsewhere. It's just a strange, strange phenomenon in the workplace these days where there are so many more demands. A couple people I saw, working 60, 70 hours a week, people with great responsibility. As soon as it's the sun sets over on the Sabbath, they got all this homework to do. It's just a trend of the time. So this third area, getting the most out of God's Sabbath day, getting the most out of God's Sabbath, because that's sacrosanct time. Nobody's supposed to infringe on that to make us work on the Sabbath. As far as, in the workplace, to have to put in overtime, no matter how busy we can get, we're not supposed to be earning a living on the Sabbath. We should be able to block that out. We should be able to count on one day out of seven where we can rest, where we're not bombarded by all of this stuff. What does the Sabbath mean to you? I've heard people say it represents a much needed rest. Well, if that's true physically, wonderful, but that's not enough. It is a prime opportunity to reconnect with the Master Universe Ruler. It's an opportunity to be able to resolve things with God, to ask God for help, to ask God to help us to have faith to be for what the future holds, or to make right decisions in certain areas, or to take care of certain needs, or to just be closer to God, to think more the way He does. Let me ask you today, what have you gotten out of the Sabbath before you got here? Well, I just got up, man. I just had to, you know, eat something and scramble here. Well, what do we get out of the day? It's a wonderful day for fellowship. It's a day to be able to rejuvenate spiritually, to pray. It's a day to study. Now, it's interesting that God required even the non-converted Israelites back in the time of Moses to have a preparation day to be able to get the most out of the Sabbath, to be able to take care of as many menial activities as possible prior to the time that the Sabbath would arrive. Now, I understand there are oxes in the ditch, but proper preparation will drastically reduce the number of oxen that fall in the ditch. There's an article that came out recently in United News by, I think it's Bonnie Grider, which has some excellent points about the value of preparing for the Holy Sabbath. But in principle, if we consider the fact that it is an opportunity, extra time, not just to rest, but to study and to pray and fellowship, the bottom line here is you get out of the Sabbath what you put into the Sabbath. If we give no anxious thought to it and it just, it just showed up. Here we are. Well, and whoop, there it goes. Then that's it's a missed opportunity. And sleeping the whole time would not be really keeping the spirit of the Sabbath, or just shooting the breeze endlessly and not having any relationship time with God would not make sense, would it? Being with God's people has intrinsic value. In Hebrews 10:25, it talks about, I'll turn there, Hebrews 10 and verse 25. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is. Exhorting, though, one another, and so much more so as you see the day approaching. And we can, that has multiple application. As the Sabbath comes, you could apply that. But also, as the millennium, a Sabbath rest, also comes, our future, God's kingdom, and as we see that day approaching, we can be ever more encouraged, and we can encourage each other. You know, iron sharpens iron. So is the countenance of a friend it can be sharpening. We can encourage each other. We can talk about the future as we assemble here. It's a blessing. So getting the most out of the Sabbath day. And I'll quote Malachi 3 and verse 16, where it says, "They that feared the Eternal spoke often one to another." And when it says fear the Eternal, it's not simply saying, oh, I'm afraid God's going to get me. No, it's awesome, deep reverence based on what one knows about how great God is. And it's a positive experience. So we want to get something out of this day, not just let it creep up on us unaware. And Bible study is important, not only our own, but taking advantage of that here in the congregation. Our conversation at church. I know that I enjoy being with other people. I enjoy a little friendly banter once in a while. That happens in Tampa, and it happens here. We can tease a little bit, maybe. But there's an important opportunity here that presents itself that we can talk about meaningful things. There's plenty to talk about. Sometimes people will say, well, you know, it just kind of seems dry, or we just talk about menial stuff. Well, that doesn't have to be. You can talk about interesting things that you may have reviewed in the previous week in your own personal Bible study. I remember meeting somebody one time, after a while we were talking. He says, well, what do you study, or what good sermons have you heard, you know, in your church area lately? And all, and he just lives for that. He's not saying this in self-righteousness. Well, we talk about the Bible, you know. No, not like that. But he really had a genuine, earnest desire. And I thought, well, you know, that's the way to look at it. I've never approached it like that. But I was impressed. But in this, you know, here at Fellowship, you could talk about why the feast is important to you. Talk about feast plans. Probably at times you've discussed trials that you or others have endured. You know, we need to pray about so-and-so. This is what he or she is going through. Maybe go visit that person if need be and appropriate. Talk about people you are praying for. Maybe talk about what you've seen in the world scene, world prophecy, that's coming alive more than ever before. And then that can say, with the conclusion and the implication, you know, even though that's scary, some of it, it does reassure us that after that, if that's true, everything else that's going to be better is surely going to happen. Steering conversation toward millennial topics. I brought some of that up with some people last week. They kind of looked at me like, huh? Huh? Well, it was pretty clear that they hadn't thought about that in a long time. Maybe archaeology, proving the veracity of the Bible. Doing this in earnest, not in self-righteousness. Sabbath conversation can sometimes be lacking. Sometimes you get a huge group of people together. The wider the circle, the more shallow it gets, because you're going for a common denominator. Unless the entire congregation's in crisis, then it's different, like it was maybe 14 years ago. With exception, I know. But, you know, some meaningful conversation can be ours. And if we utilize the Sabbath with forethought, we will increase our zeal and we will increase our faith. So this is a gold mine of opportunity, just being with each other. A fourth area, reading, studying, meditating on the examples of God's interventions. Studying, reading, meditating on the examples of God's interventions. Seeing the hand of God at work will build faith. Healings, for example. I marvel at some of the healings that God has blessed people with. I don't always know why and how he does it. I don't have I don't think there's a predictable formula for it. God chooses his time according to many different reasons, and reasons that he may explain to us in detail later. 1976 in Toronto at a church picnic, there was a toddler that somehow very quickly escaped, wandered away from his parents and away from the church activity, and got close to a highway. The driver that slowed down to a stop later said, I was going 55 miles an hour. I never saw that little guy. But as this child got close to this very, very busy highway with a lot of traffic, a number of about 30 brethren looked over to see that this child was ready to go right into the street. And they were shrieking and screaming like, oh no. And this one guy in particular, going that fast, was encroaching rapidly. And as at the point of juncture when he would have run that child over, an invisible force threw that child up in the air, did a somersault, and then slowly landed down on the grass on the side of the highway. And then was quickly and frantically scooped up by its mother. God's ways are beyond finding out, but there are things that have happened. And that particular incident had a number of witnesses to it. We've had people that were working in steel mills where the bucket of molten, not lava, but it was about the same thing, molten melted steel, spilled, landed on the person, and not a hair was singed. Just went like with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So there have been times of divine intervention. I've mentioned some of these in the past. Others have. And when you talk about that, it's amazing. Others will share things with you. Two women that were driving to very close friends were sure they were going to be scrunched in an accident. And they saw their car. Well, the car in front stopped, and other cars came from the side, and they couldn't stay where they were, and they couldn't move forward, and yet they did move forward, and they could see the outline of their car pass through another vehicle, and they ended up on the side intact, no scratches. I don't know how. But I not only marvel, I think, isn't it great that God didn't wait for those people to become perfect? And he doesn't wait for you and I to become absolutely perfect, because sometimes we don't do everything that we're supposed to. He doesn't wait for that in order to say, I love them, and in this particular case, I choose to help them. You know, God can do that. But what a waste if we don't get to know him. What a waste if we don't invest any time in order to have the strategy of saying, you know what, he can be my God. He can be answering my prayers. He can be looking out for me. Not that I want to be selfish. I want him to do that for everybody else. But he can do that because he is the great God. And I have the opportunity to reconnect with him on the Sabbath and throughout the week. Are we getting as much out of our lives as we could? Do we want to have the faith for the future? And the faith for the future involves this. There are so many examples of divine intervention and that we don't dare take them for granted. Again, I think of a young couple starting out in life, and they were on their way to churches in Hagerstown, Maryland. And it's not like they were perfect angels, if you know what I mean. But they were finding their way back to God, and they broke down the side of the highway. And suddenly a red sports car showed up, and somebody hopped out and says, hey, looks like you got car problems. Open up the hood, you know, let me work on this. Who is this guy? Oh, I think this goes here, and the left bone connects to the thigh bone, and it means that much to me. Anyway, I'm not a mechanic, but anyway, he says at the end, well, I think that's pretty good. Why don't you start that up? Yeah, the car starts right up. And he says, well, see you later. I got to go see my children in Hagerstown. So this the interstate highway, people are going at 70 miles an hour. Cars would come by where this now fixed vehicle was parked, and go at 70 miles an hour, would go down this dip, and then come out this runout. And so the red car got started first. It revved up, went up to 70 miles an hour, went over the hill, and it never came out the other side. He could see trucks coming along, disappear, and then they showed up. But they could see for miles out, the red car was gone. Sounds like Twilight Zone time. But could it have been an angel? And isn't that maybe a manifestation of God's love? And says, now I'm going to see my children in Hagerstown. How about are there people that have said or thinking that are invisible that say, I think I'm going to go over to St. Pete Clearwater and see my children over there because I love them, because they're important to me, because out of all the millions of people that could have responded to the message, to the warning message, and to the calling, these are the ones that are the salt of the earth. These are the ones that I want to invest in the future, but I sure hope they'll have a relationship with me. I hope they'll take advantage of the Sabbath. I hope they'll have vision for the future. I hope they understand why they were born, etc., etc. Well, why not? There's no telling what God can do for us, but it depends on us. He's waiting for us. There was a man in Bristol, England, back in the 1850s that had a vision. He wanted to raise up orphanages, and he was wanting to do that. He was a minister, different organization, but the main thing that stands out to me is that he just wanted to obey God as best as he could, and he wanted God to bless his efforts to help fatherless children and want to establish orphanages. And he wanted to do that without asking and begging for money anywhere. And he had to start out small. But as he maintained his vision, his wife was very much supportive. He prayed for the money to operate such a venture. And so it was amazing how God seemed to always be there for him. And people would donate furniture. They'd donate blankets. People would come to him out of the blue. You don't know me, sir. His name was George Mueller. But I want to be a part of this. And I'll work for free. Or I want to give you this money that I'd saved up for a different cause that's no longer needed. So he was able to do that. He bought one building, then another, then another. By the time he died around 1900, the entire nation mourned for him. He was known by millions of people. But he worked one step at a time. It was interesting, one time he at their first orphanage, they wanted to have a grand opening. They announced to everybody that anybody that had children that or knew of some that were homeless, by all means, let them come to this orphanage. That's what it's there for. It's for them. It's free. And they had the blankets. They prayed for that. They prayed for help. They got people willing to serve. And everything was all lined up. And then they sat back, with their opened the doors, waited for the people to file in. They knew that there was a desperate need. And they couldn't believe it. The whole day went, came and went, and not a single soul enrolled a child or took advantage of it. Some distant relative, you'd think somebody would know somebody, but nobody showed up. And he was devastated. And he thought, God, why did you leave me to do this? You gave me the money, gave me the land, gave me the building, gave me the people, and all of this. And now we opened our doors and nobody's here. And then his wife started to think, and then she started to giggle and laugh. And he said, what's wrong? You should be frustrated like me. And she said, you know what? We prayed for the money. We prayed for the building. We prayed for the blankets. We prayed for the beds. And we forgot to pray for the children. We just assumed that they would just file on in here. And so they both laughed, and they went. And they prayed about it right there, and they prayed about it that evening, and then the next morning, and boy, did the children come. And they filled that building up within a day, and they had a waiting list. That tells us, I think, how specific we have to be. You know, this is not, oh, God, oh, bless everything. Bless the work. I've seen people do that, or give a opening, prayer, at a meal. Oh, thank you for this turkey sandwich, and bless the work. I hope you endure. I hope you're happy. The broader it is, the more shallow it is. If you want a real relationship with somebody, you wouldn't do that. You would talk about specific things. And God's a specific entity. He's a real person. And why not be specific? And sometimes God doesn't move until we are detailed in what we communicate with Him. There was a time when George Mueller was and had four orphanages, and he was approached by one of his employees, and who was nervous, and said, we haven't gotten any money in our funding today. People would donate at this donation box, and so we're out of food, and here it is middle of the winter time, and I don't know, the kids are going to starve if something doesn't happen. And he says, don't worry about it. He says, just seat them in the dining hall. Well, we don't have any food. We don't want to lead them on. Maybe we'll tell them that if they can hold out tomorrow, we can go scrounge them up and set them down. Don't worry about it. So they're sitting down, and so the children believe they're going to have a meal to eat. And Mr. Mueller informed everybody that that was the case. And he may not have been able to do that 30 years before, but after he said that, and he was silently praying, there was a knock at the door, and the milkman said, you know what? My milk truck broke down right here, and it's shivering cold outside in the middle of January, and I realize that by the time I go into town and bring back help to get this milk, it's going to be frozen, worthless. So could I leave it here? Could you use that? He says, yeah, I think we can work it in. Yeah, come on, bring it in. So then a few minutes later, there was another knock at the door. And this bread man was standing there. He said, my bread truck broke down right in front of this building, and this bread is going to be frozen before I can get people back here to take it into the town, to take it to market. Can I leave it here with you? Can you guys use this? Well, yes, we can. And there was a meal after all, and afterwards certain donations came in again. And Mr. Mueller wrote about that and other incidences. With his whole lifelong experience, he made the observation, and it's so true, and it's true with us. Where faith begins, anxiety ends. But where anxiety begins, faith ends. So where faith begins, anxiety ends. Where anxiety begins, faith ends. Do you want to live in anxiety? I don't. Not if I can help it inwardly. Do you want to idle and neutral spiritually and kind of fritter away time and just kind of float and go along with it and just see what happens? I don't. I don't think you do. Why would we? Final area is pray for a spiritual transformation to increase our value to God and to others. Pray for a spiritual transformation. That means take advantage of God's Holy Spirit, His mind, the blessings of the Bible, blessings that are shown that we can reap. If we only live life once, why wouldn't we want to do that? Praying for a spiritual transformation to increase our value to God and to others. In 1900, in one community in the nation of Wales, electricity was being introduced to homeowners. They never had it before. And the electric company wanted people to sample it. So they hooked people up and they said, you know what, there are wonderful things that you can do with electricity that you could not do up until now. And you can have it for free. And if you want to sign a contract after a few months, then we'll be glad to do that. So there was one couple that hooked up, but they hardly ever used their electricity. And when the trial period was done, the representatives came out and said, well, would you like to sign a contract? And they said, oh, no, I don't think so. Doesn't really matter. And then they checked their electric meter and they said, well, yeah, why you've hardly used any electricity. What did you use it for at all then? They said, well, we use the electricity at night. We turn on the lights to find the kerosene lamps, and then when we found them, we shut off the electricity. This is the way we've done it, and this is the way we always do it. They never took advantage of the electricity, and the representative said, well, don't you realize why you could run hot water? You could have an electric stove. You could have lights. You could have an electric sewing machine. You could have an iron that you could turn on and get quick results. Why, if you had any other motors, you could have them running. Why, you could have a lot of things going on here. But they never took advantage of it. They saw no reason. To me, it's like, it makes as much sense as if you were given a credit card and told by the company, look, you can get anything you want, and we'll reimburse. So if you want that Hawaiian vacation or go to New Zealand, why, you can just charge it and it's paid for. You can do anything you want. And let's say that opportunity was given to somebody, and after a year, the agent came back and says, why, the only thing you bought was a Pac-Man game. That's it. You didn't buy anything. Why, you could have had a Corvette. You could have had a mansion. You could have had world travel. Well, you could have helped other people. You could have built a hospital. Well, you could have built 100 hospitals. Why, you could have owned the world. You could have used things. Who knows what you could have done, but you got this Pac-Man game. That's it. Well, that's all I wanted. All I thought that I needed. What about God? We can have more than an okay relationship with Him. We can have more than a relationship where we're sort of half there and but not taking advantage of it. Why would we want to go there? When we can have so much more, when life can mean so much more for us. You know, I look at many of our people that are retired. They may not have the health that they would wish, but they do have the golden asset of time. And then I look at people that are younger. They may not have as much time, but they have their health. And for all of us, rather than idle and neutral, which is a waste of life, what could our lives be if we prayed for spiritual transformation? If we meditated on the examples of God's intervention, knowing full well that there are going to be future interventions and maybe some that will personally be extended to us? Getting the most out of God's Sabbath day, praying for spiritual discernment, having vision for the future, knowing that we're part of something bigger than ourselves, that changes the situation drastically. Having enough faith for the future, making our relationship real. If I had drastically increased faith for the future, how much more could I ask for God's help in my life or in the lives of others? So let's, as I conclude here, consider that there are some important ways to increase faith: having vision for the future, asking for spiritual discernment, getting the most out of God's Sabbath, reading and reviewing and meditating God's interventions, praying for spiritual transformation. These are not just accidental happenstance activities. These are efforts that have destination and result. And the less we are doing these things, then we are living life with outmoded spiritual strategy. Or maybe you don't even call it strategy at all. So spiritually speaking, I think we can see that our spiritual highway in life needs to be a lot wider than 56 inches